Previously on X-Friends.
It takes me back to this notion of fate. And in a time travel story, that's very important.
When Morph shows up with that baseball, I was like, not the time. Like, ever. What do you
read
mean?
The room, Morph. I don't know if this is the case, but does Morph absorb the powers of the person that he becomes?
We talked about this last season, and we were like, yeah,
we don't know.
I guess. Like, maybe? At which point, he is actually the most powerful. What I really, really like about this version of Magneto is they make him so reasonable. And I truly feel that his ideals go toe-to-toe with Charles.
Even with the bone claws, Wolverine, he puts exclamations on his thoughts, or at least his statements, by popping out the claws.
And I put in my notes, Forged would have to be working out at an incredible rate, just in the gym, nonstop. Forge is working out all the time.
He built new gym equipment that does it faster.
And that's possible. And I thought of that too. I was like, maybe he has nanobots inside of him that just work out his muscles. But Forge, I feel like they want a little bit too much with Forge. You know why this works? Because they take it so seriously. Storm talks to the sun, and it is like she's praying to God. And it made me realize, this type of material does work. It works when you give it the respect that it deserves and you treat it like a real story.
Hi, everybody, and thank you for joining us. I am Nick Scheist. You may remember me from the Scheist Podcast and Bad Movies We Love.
And I'm Seth Vargas of the Movie Friends Podcast.
And we decided to join forces. A team up, if you will, because X-Men 97 was so good, we just couldn't help ourselves.
That's right. So join us as we discuss our personal history with the comics, the films, and the collectible trading cards of the X-Men universe.
And of course, the catalyst for it all, X-Men 97.
To me, my X-Friends.
We are back with another episode of X Force 97. Surprise. But you didn't see that one coming.
I didn't.
Most people did not, actually. But when they revealed the opening credits, they redirected the entire credits to feature X Force. And Larry Houston, the director and EP, was there talking about that, actually, when they were doing some crowd Q&A stuff. And he was so excited for it. And he was like, man, I knew we were going to blow people's minds when we did this. And it's crazy. It's a show where there's a lot of memes on the internet where it's you don't skip the intro for X-Men 97. Right. No. Yeah, and so I accidentally did it last night when I was watching the new episode, and I went back and started from the beginning, and I was like, no, you don't get to skip this. So knowing that people don't skip the intro, I think, is an important component in wanting to present the X-Force version of the intro.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's very cool, very neat. I appreciated it.
Yeah, crowd went nuts. I mean, they were going wild for everything, but this was a big win. I made notes of all of the biggest wins, during the screening, and they're still doing the episodes every Wednesday at that bar. I just have not been back out for the screening. But it is a cool environment. If you're in the Hollywood area, go to Scum and Villainy. You just got to get there and line up early, and maybe you'll see me there. Maybe wearing this hat and a Cyclops t-shirt.
There you go.
There's and cosplay.
How much
drinks.
It's worth. So you'll take it off of his head.
Yeah, wait. I meant it was $2.80. this is an interesting episode for a number of reasons. I think primarily for me because of three main things. Number one, the tone in terms of, well, actually, I'm going to say four main things.
Okay.
The tone when it comes to like how dark the episode gets when it wants to. Mm-hmm. Number two, the use of X Factor, who is also in this episode, as essentially Ice. Right. The third thing.
Imagine how confused I was keeping X Factor and X Force straight in my head. But yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting to see them both at the same time, but I also realized that a big part of me really loves watching the hero teams fight each other, because when there's a villain involved, like, yeah, things will probably not go well for the X-Men for a while, but they will triumph, right? The cards are always in the X-Men's favor.
Yeah.
One of the best lines from season one. But when you have two hero teams fighting each other, it's like, who's actually gonna win this? It was one of the big things in X-Men versus Avengers that it was like, oh, who actually is gonna win this? You have the Avengers fans. Like, it becomes very tribal at that point. Right. And I don't think X-Factor has like a big enough fan base to really push that, where like X-Force becomes in many iterations like the Hit Squad, especially in the most recent version. Like, Beast becomes kind of like a ruthless general of X-Force, sending them out to like kill a lot of people. And so to see in this episode like the lengths that they're willing to go to in order to secure the future, and also like where that rubs up against the teachings of Charles and like with his students, we got that. We got X-Factor as Ice. We get a crazy needle drop with Veruca Salt, Volcano Girls, and Jubilee rocking out. That was unexpected, but like Jubilee is getting her moment in the sun in both of these seasons. Really, someone said it was like they had one better needle drop in the show than Supergirl had in the whole movie. And it like I watched the scene again today, and it is very, very fun to watch it. And I think fourth would be Guy Augustini, who plays Sunspot. I think he has the best line maybe of the season so far in terms of what the X-Men represent or what they should represent. In Jubilee getting left behind of her own accord, Cable being like, we have to evacuate, we can't go back for her right now, she can handle herself, and Sunspot saying, just because she can do it alone doesn't mean she should have to.
Right.
And I feel like that is such like a strong statement that I think in maybe the past would have been looked at as like weakness, like, oh, you're going to go back for your girlfriend. And it's like, it's not about that. It's sort of like, no man left behind. We're a team.
Yeah.
And she probably can do this by herself, but like, we should be there to help her. Like, and so like, it speaks to this level of sort of like community and team that Cable is not really used to, because he's coming from a future where it's like kind of like a lot of the people he knows have died in that future that he's coming from. And so to have a team that still like believes in that and still echoes some of those teachings of Xavier, you know, I think it's an interesting line in the sand to show like the future that Cable has come from. And can you soften a soldier like that, right? Can you bend that kind of will to really begin to recognize, for lack of a better word, the humanity in a statement like that from Roberto?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that Cable has to have something inside of him that hopes for and believes in that, because if not, it's like, what's the point of everything? You know, like the point is to restore things to the way that they were. And, you know, for better or for worse, Charles School for Gifted Youngsters is the place that keeps being returned to. So, yeah. I was shocked by this episode. I was kind of like, are we doing a Jubilee doesn't know how strong she is thing again, because we have a whole episode about that in the first season, which is a good episode. And ultimately shows you like, yeah, actually Jubilee is like very, very powerful and very, very strong. And so this time around, I was like, I don't want to retread that. But I feel like they don't do it too much.
No, she gets a good scene, but the episode is not about her like learning that she can be more powerful, right? She's like the most senior X-Men that is in this group right here. Roberto like just turned his powers on at the end of the last season for the first time, so he's still kind of learning. He's in the Jubilee role from the original run of the show, where she was the newcomer and she's the kid learning, right? The thing that we talked about in episode one, where it's like there's always sort of a kid who is learning their powers, who is being mentored by an older statesman on the team. And so Jubilee is kind of like the representative of the X-Men here, and you hear her like lecture Polaris about this as well. She's like, the X-Men, you know, you used to be one of them. So like, she's carrying the torch for this, not just the team, but like the identity and the ideals of what it means to be the X-Men, even in a world that hates you and hates a lot of mutants, like to still try to do the right thing. And so that comes into direct conflict with Cable and his approach, and the bowl cut bad guy who, I mean, he looked like he was like out of the 80s, right?
Yeah. And I was very glad that we did end up acknowledging the bowl cut. Because I was like, what is happening here? This is absolutely outrageous.
How does he blend into a crowd? I mean, I get that like mutants are commonplace, but how does that Frankenstein with the bowl cut blend into like a party in the middle of the street?
Yeah. And then he's wearing like a Last Starfighter jumpsuit that's like, like he looks straight up like a G.I. Joe. Like, he looks like one of the G.I. Joes that you would have wanted, because he looks so different. Like he's not trying to hide, but then ultimately that's the point, is that he's not trying to hide, because this is all a grand, you know, trap ultimately. I gotta tell you, you know, a lot of times in movies and TV shows, you'll set up somebody being shot, and then you'll hear a gun go off, and then you'll see the gun, and then you'll see how the person just fired into the ground or fired into the air. And I was like, oh, like when we cut from the gunshot to the smoking gun, I was like, oh, that's lame. They're doing that trick. Oh, my God. They killed him.
Yep.
Could not believe it.
I assume in the head.
Believe it. And I feel that I can say this because we're talking about, you know, a world where a world that is not real. I'm siding with Cable on this one. Like, I'm sorry. The fate of everything is at stake. I hate in movies when they're like, no, we can't let this person sacrifice themselves so that every person on the earth can live. That is not, that's no gamble. That's no question. If you and I were legitimately in a situation where one of us had to die, and I was like, no, Nick, you can't. I would be pushing you. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and not because
this is why you got voted Magneto.
Well, it's like, but it's like not because I want you to die, or not because I would want myself to die, but you and I would look at each other and be like, well, there's no question about this now, right? Like,
yeah,
hello?
You would think so.
You would think so. And so Jubilee, I was like, Jubilee, this dude is one of Apocalypse's four horsemen. His name is War. I don't think he might be a good guy. She's like, we can turn him over to the authorities. I'm like,
what authorities?
What like authorities? And Cable says, I'm the authority. And I was like, yes, you are. Correct. Yes, Cable, you are judge, jury, and executioner. I am one of the few people who likes Judge Dredd. You know what I mean? Like, I think that that's a, you know,
I am the law.
Yeah, no, all of that was not true. But in this world, like in this science fiction world, I don't feel the same stakes as I do in our real life. And so if Cable's like, hey, we're going to kill this guy because if we don't, a billion people will die. I'm like, yeah, Cable, shoot him.
That's fair. And it makes me wonder, like, we know Cable's from the future. I think there is an understanding that he's from the future. But, like, if there was somebody in our lives who was like, yeah, I'm from the future, the future's bad, listen to what I'm telling you. Okay, we acknowledge that you're from the future and that the future's bad, but you just told me to kill this guy. I still don't want to do that. And so, like, is Jubilee's experience with Cable that, like, she maybe hasn't seen what he has seen and right. hasn't, like, lived a life that has now pushed her to the point of, like, oh, you do have to make some tough decisions
I mean, I don't blame Jubilee for doing that, for exactly what you just said. Yeah, she can't suddenly be different. But I was like, Cable, why are you even trying to hand her the gun? Like, just do it. Like, why is there even a discussion? Like, if you were going to do this from the get-go, just shoot me. You got a whole arm that can turn into something. Like, you know, I don't know, do some crazy stuff, man. Why are you handing child?
And why does he make Archangel do it in the first place, other than, you know, Archangel was taken over by Apocalypse at one point as a horseman, so he's got like some vengeance
right
here, kill him for revenge, because that's probably the best way to do this. But I also sort of wondered, why does Archangel need a gun? Like, if I'm not, like, his wings are made out of adamantium, aren't they? Couldn't he just cut this dude's head off?
Yeah, well, maybe you gotta clean it after.
Yeah. Don't want that dude's blood on your wings. But I mean, his wings also shoot like sharp blades and stuff.
Right.
I guess Cable's just got the gun. He's got the super gun from the future that's gonna it's gonna handle all the business. Let's talk about X-Factor a little bit, because, you know, they're an important part of like X-Men's history. You do get Havoc, Cyclops's younger brother. You get Polaris, Strong Guy, Wolfsbane. One of my favorite mutants totally is Jamie Madrix, Multiple Man. And we get to see him using some of his Multiple Man powers to torment some young children, as you know, as a hero does. But yeah, I felt like there was not, it was not even very thinly veiled at all that this was alluding to like what we've seen with Ice, right? You have a team of mutants like hunting other mutants, rounding them up, kids, putting them in a camp, detainment facility with really like no jurisdiction and no plan for them. So I felt like, you know, for the X-Men to have continuously been a story sort of about marginalized people and minorities in a world that doesn't like or want them, I felt like this is probably like the most modernized version of this that you could do. So I feel like I liked it in the context of the story, but I also like had to ask myself, like, would any of these X-Men really be like, oh yeah, I want to hunt other mutants for the government, right? Like, how far gone are they that they feel like this is an appropriate solution?
Yes, I do think so, because we see it happening in our own world. And it's like, just because you are something doesn't mean you think a certain way. And people act against their own interests all the time, unfortunately. So totally, I totally think. I do think it's funny that, like, in every form of superhero media, like, siding with the government is just an automatic signal of, like, you're a butt. Like, you suck in some way.
Yeah. I mean, because we see the relationship with the government in season one, too, right? Like, Magneto has this entire speech where he's like, I could literally, like, kill you all and do whatever I want, but because of people that I care about who believe in your goodness and your ability to, you know, change, essentially, mm-hmm. I don't want to do this thing that I have every right at this point to mm-hmm. do. You tried to assassinate me.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably all do deserve a worse fate than that, but he holds back. And so this contentious relationship between not just like the government, I mean, Senator Kelly is like one of the key roles in the X-Men story, right? You know, Charles getting depowered is a big element of the end of the first run of the show. Like, an assassin comes and shoots him with like an anti-mute gun.
Right.
So like all of the parallels to like civil rights activists and their struggles with the government, like, it's all there. So I'm glad that we're not seeing that sort of pushed aside. Right. Like, this show does not have to be like, hey, we're going to address this thing. Right. The X-Men is big right. enough and I think has enough political commentary throughout it to not have to be maybe as specific right. as they chose to be.
Right.
But I feel like it is an important thing to include in this.
Right. You know, excuse me. And then adding in, you know, Emma Frost, who's just like not really being on either side, just being on the side of money and like yeah. just selling people out for money.
It does make her a great character, unfortunately. Like, mm-hmm. she's very fun to watch because she's so willing to just like, you know, be involved with whatever side is paying her. And there's a reason that, you know, she leads the Hellfire Club. mm-hmm. That's her job. There are some other cameos that we see in this episode. And I was trying to like figure out, okay, like which characters are which. And Kid Omega is one of them. Quentin Quire. He's the like the Mohawk glasses. He's wearing the Magneto Was Right shirt. Mm-hmm. Chamber, who has the scarf over his mouth and the kind of like spiky hair. We also see the Stepford Cuckoos, who are the biological children of Emma Frost in some incarnation. So they're like, it's like five of them are like a hive mind Ooh. Telepath.
Ooh.
And they have a very interesting story when things get cooking with them, because like a couple of them die and like each of them have different personalities, but they function as a hive mind, which is very cool. And we also see Glob, who is like a big gelatinous monster mm-hmm. where you can see like their skeleton. mm-hmm. So there's a lot of characters that are mutant characters who will potentially get their opportunities later, but we'll see. I think, if anything, my biggest, I don't want to say criticism, but my biggest issue with the show overall is that I feel like they're going too fast. And I think I said this in season one also, mm. is that, you know, we're burning through the Days of Future Past storyline like really right. quickly.
Right.
And I'm like, this is a huge part of X-Men's history. And it's like, okay, here's the two episodes and moving on.
Right.
And so I think on the one hand, if you're only going to have like an 8 or 9 episode season because the animation takes a while to complete and the direction of all that takes a while, it may be the one thing with the X-Men animated universe where we've talked a lot about maybe animation is the way for right. superhero stories to be told. Like, yeah. considering the DC universe's struggles with their live action stuff, but like their animated films like are fantastic. They're all good. I don't think I've ever seen a bad one, maybe one that I didn't really love. But they're all very good. So I'm worried a little bit that we're going to kind of like run out of runway at some point with this show if we don't slow down a little bit. And some of these stories actually, I think, just deserve a little bit more breathing room as well, because these aren't hour long dramas. These are like, they range from 30 minutes. Maybe, I think this one was 30, you know?
Yeah.
And so some of them are longer, some of them are not. But yeah, that's the one thing that I really worry about. There's no shortage of X-Men stories, but if everything is X-Men 97, like if we're not going to switch to X-Men 98, 99, and kind of if we're not going to grow with them in the way that the comics grew with them, then we are going to run out of runway at some point. And all you can really do at that point is time travel. And we're already doing that right now. So that's the thing I'm worried about. It's like, yes, you could, of course, time travel again. But then it's like, oh, we're back to time travel because we've run out of options.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, it was 2 years between seasons. So it's not like this is getting produced super fast. They've already been picked up again, I think, for two more seasons. Mm. So they're going to keep making them. And I hope they're working on them now. And maybe those are questions for, you know, people in the know. But. Yeah, I think that is my only sort of issue. But you had a specific issue in episode two that you wanted to mention.
I did. On that point, though, I will say I thought the same thing. Like, as I was watching this, I was like, wow, we're really just doing Apocalypse. Like, that wasn't just the little cliffhanger and then maybe we'd kind of like, no, this is it. This is the Apocalypse season, and maybe it will resolve itself and maybe it won't. Maybe they'll bring, you know, it into a second season. Who knows? But it did feel insane. I was like, they're just going straight to it. And okay. I mean, that's fine. There is something, well, we'll save it for next episode, but you know, they're hinting at like some larger things happening, which it's interesting, but I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe they'll do a big storyline like this, and then maybe next season will just be about, you know, they'll focus on one character. Maybe it'll be the Nightcrawler season. Who knows? I don't know. I think that they have good, talented writers working here. The dialogue is good. The character, I mean, I feel like this is like so efficient in giving like in-depth character development to everyone all the time. Like all the time. When I was watching the recap of season one, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Remember when Nightcrawler started using the sword with his tail too?
Prehensile tail goes a long way.
Just, yeah. Like not that necessarily everyone is growing, but like just having little arcs and having places to go when you have so many characters at once. I watched these few episodes with my younger son, who's 5.
Okay.
And as the intros are changing and there's whole new groups of people in each intro and each episode, we're dealing with different teams. He actually said to me, he's like, how many good guys are there? And I was like, oh, like 100. And then he's like, how many bad guys are there? I was like, oh, like 50. And he actually said, he's like, so that'll be like 150. And I was like, wow, did you just add 150 together? That's pretty good. And then I was like, oh, yeah. But he was so, he just couldn't believe the amount of characters that were in this. And yeah, like the care that they give into developing them, I think that they could probably choose to be like, this is the Storm season and we're just going to do a bunch of Storm stuff. I think that they could pull it off. Okay. Now, the thing that I was in love with this episode.
Okay.
So Cable is like, at the end of the last episode, he's like, Apocalypse is going to go where the X-Men are the weakest. And that's the 90s. So it's like, okay, Cable is going recruiting. Who is left at this point, kind of? He meets up with Jubilee and Sunspot. They're sitting in like a Chili's, basically. Like, Okay, that is very funny to me.
It's like a diner, maybe like a dive bar or something like that.
Yeah,
but yeah.
But it's like an arcade because behind him is a
Dave
big
and Buster.
And I was like, oh, you know, there is a character named Arcade, but you know. So Cable.
Yep.
A man from the future.
Yep.
A hardened soldier of a future war.
Yes, sir.
Whips out a manila folder with a photograph of Apocalypse with a paperclip on it.
It's the dossier.
Why does he have, like, you and I wouldn't have this. You and I would have this information on a phone. We live only 30 years after this time period. And I love the idea of Cable, like, getting off of his ship and then, like, starting to head for the, and then be like, oh, no, wait, where's my, oh, hold on. And he's got to go back. And be like, oh, forgot this. Yep. All right, guys, I'll be back. Hopefully they say yes. Wish me luck. When he whips out that folder, I started laughing. Like, it's so full. It's full of, like, all these different photos and, like, names and, like, scribblings. And I'm like, this cannot be how Cable is getting this done. No wonder he's unable to stop Apocalypse. He's working like a gumshoe in, like, 1957. Like, oh, my God. I loved it. And they kept showing it. They showed it like four times during their conversation.
Look, he worked hard on that, okay?
Yes. And I was like, whoever animated this had to know how funny this was. Like, please. Anyway, that was my big thing with this episode.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you go harder on that joke and you show Cable, the hardened war veteran that he is, having to go in to an office supply store?
Yes, exactly.
And print.
Yes,
these copies.
Who's doing this stuff? You know what I mean? Like, someone had to buy. And again, like, where did he get that? Do they have manila folders in his time?
No, he did this here in the 90s. You know, he had to work. Crazy. I don't know where the picture came from. Maybe he stole it from a newspaper. But for a guy who's got like a living computer in his arm, probably could have just been
Polaroid,
like,
Polaroid of Apocalypse. Like, someone had to walk up to him, center him in the frame, and go click, and then shake the picture until it developed.
It's when he fought Apocalypse in like the 80s, you know?
Oh my God. It's so funny. It's, if you're listening to this, just pull it up again.
Yeah.
Watch it. You'll die laughing. It's so funny.
I think the exclamation point on the fact that the writers know that this is funny, but still take it seriously, is that Cable also is enjoying a milkshake.
Mm-hmm.
And like, he sort of sinks in his seat a little bit and pulls the straw up and slurps the milkshake. And that moment in the crowd played very, very well. Because who doesn't love a milkshake? I mean, look, if you're in a horrible future and you get to come back to the 90s, it's like, well, I'm going to have a milkshake.
Yes, absolutely. And like, that also made me wonder, okay, so Cable, you're traveling back to track Apocalypse to a time
where there's milkshakes.
I just, right. It's like, it's so convenient that you knew when to go back to.
I will Cable's only like, fight him back in like, the 90s. Oh,
when did they invent Shake Shack? I think that Apocalypse, we should check that out.
Yeah. Look, he's smart. All right. He's tactical. Mm-hmm. If we're going to have to, you know, fight this guy who's going to end the world, I want to do it in the 90s, where, you know, things were at the peak of human civilization, according to the Wachowski. So, look, I get it, man. Enjoy yourself a milkshake. You might die.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would have a milkshake if I knew that was my last meal. Chocolate peanut butter milkshake is like my second favorite dessert of all time.
I mean, it's not a bad choice. You're like, hey, we might die after this.
Yeah.
You know what? read the dossier while I have a milkshake. You guys have homework to do, but I do not.
Right.
Exactly. All right. This was a short episode overall. There's one more thing that like popped into my head again on the parenting thing, because there is again in this, like sort of going back to the theme of like what it means to be like a responsible parent under like incredible stress. And like what I wrote down is that being a mutant parent is probably one of the more interesting aspects of the X-Men universe, because so many of the kids were parented by people who didn't want them.
Right.
And so they're all sort of like in this chosen family. And so like those bonds really, I think, play out for a lot of those specific reasons. And we got a little bit of it with Roberto and his mom, where she sort of disowns him in season one. But it happens a lot throughout the course of X-Men history, where there's always like a parent who's like afraid of their kid or abandons them or abuses them in many cases. So I'm curious to see like how much of a through line that will be as the rest of the season plays out, because it's only 9 episodes this time. It's not 10.
Mm.
And they've already sort of. That's true. We'll see. We will see.
Remember when everyone was convinced Stranger Things had a secret finale?
Wow, I did not hear that rumor, but I didn't even watch the final season yet, so.
Me either. But, you know.
We're not the authorities on Stranger Things. We're the authorities on the X-Men.
Bad that everyone was like, no, that's not the real one.
Oh, wow. Okay, now I gotta watch it. Now we're talking.
Yeah, you're right. They spent another $50 million on a secret.
Yeah, and it's coming in 5 more years.
Yeah.
Just keep hanging on. All right. Well, I think that's all I had for episode 2, unless you got anything for us.
Let me see.
What else is in the dossier?
Yeah, let me flip. Nope. That's it.
All right. Well, we'll see you for the next one. Thanks for checking out the show and becoming an X-Friend. Hopefully you'll join us on our journey through X-Men 97 and beyond. X-Friends is a Movie Friends and Bad Movies We Love co-production and part of the Scheist Podcast Network, hosted by Seth Vargas and me, Nick Scheist. You can find all of our contact info and socials in the show notes, and you can email the show directly at xfriends@thescheist.com. That's the letter X - friends at thescheist.com. So until next time, just because someone stumbles and loses their way doesn't mean they're lost forever.